Okay, so I'm going to be talking about whether we can use essentially whether we can use field experiments to get useful information on crop response to temperature. And I come from originally from a botany background, and I think botany doesn't exist as a field anymore. But when I was a graduate student, you have to have precise control. You have to do it in a controlled environment if you're going to get meaningful insights. And I would argue that there's lots of evidence that that's not the case. First reminder, of course, is there's beautiful variation in temperature, you know, within the U.S. Why would you use a growth chamber if you've got this kind of variation? And of course, we're down here in April and June. We're the warmest part of the U.S. So field-based approaches to vary temperature. You can use locations with elevation gradients or latitudinal gradients. For annual crops, you can exploit seasonal variation in temperature. And then on top of that, you can layer in artificial manipulations. Bruce Kimball has developed this very nice infrared heating system, the T-phase system. You can use enclosures, soil heating, and other approaches. So we've got a range of options then to work with temperature. And also say there's nothing new under the sun. Those of you who remember your Ecology 1 or Bio 1 class, you always learned about Klaus and Keck and Heise, and they worked on an altitudinal gradient in California. And this is variation in ecotype, so these are different varieties collected at different locations. But here they grew 5 ecotypes at 3 different elevations and saw the big G by E effect. So even back in the 1940s, people were using field studies to characterize plant response to temperature. Advantages to field studies, of course, first is that it's real world. I always emphasize we need to deal not with individual plants, but plants in a community, in a community of economic plants as a crop. We need to think about the influence of microclimate, responses related to acclimation, interactions of soil, and as Greg just showed, with water deficits. We like to ensure an adequate soil volume so we're not getting artifacts from constraining the crop growth. This does mean we need large numbers of temperature regimes, so that's both a virtue and a drawback. We can get large numbers of temperature regimes using field conditions. We can test our results directly in simulation models, and we can examine long-term responses. Very hard to do a 5-year temperature study in a growth chamber. Just keeping the chamber running is bad enough. On the downside, there's always the argument about lack of precise control. Some people would say this is a fiction, that growth chambers and greenhouses are as bad as the field. Let's see. So that also means we suffer some unreplicability. We do need more treatments or environments, and also the potential of confounding with other factors such as water and nutrient management or photoperiod. And also you could argue the long duration of field studies. If you need just to look at something, a very short-term response, maybe field's not the best. Just some examples then. This is Colombia and South America. I don't think the red letters show up very well, but Santa Fe is 600 meters, Cali 1,000 meters, Popayan 1,800 meters, Patia back down to 700 meters, and 2,700 meters. And many years ago, Doug Lang and his assistant Silvio Zuluaga grew 250 common bean lines at these five locations, and I think this data is for the best yielding line at each location. So we get low yields at cool temperatures up around 20 degrees. We get our optimal yield, and then going back down, and somewhere around 29 degrees, they're estimating that you're going to get no yield. So you don't need a simulation model. You don't need anything to get a rough idea of temperature response in common bean. And of course, working at the equator, they're factoring out effects to a large extent of photoperiod or differential variation. And I often think for climate change, we should just buy, 10 locations on the equator and do a lot of our research there. I tried something somewhat similar, taking a database of wheat lines at CIMMYT and then getting mean temperature for each of the locations, mean temperature during the growing season. Then I ran the simulation model, simulating or using two different assumptions for temperature. One was essentially 15 degrees for sort of the corner of the optimal response, 15 both for vegetative and reproductive, and then 15 and 20, 26 for the alternate. And so the points then are the real world data, and the simulated, these are the simulated responses. And I guess first thing to say is that it looks like somewhere down here with a mean temperature of 8 or 9, your yields are gonna go way down, and that somewhere with a mean temperature above 26, you're not gonna be growing wheat. And then with the models, what we do see is some differences, not surprisingly, depending on what temperature we assume. I can't see anything going on in grain yield, but here it did look like that by allowing a higher temperature for the reproductive phase, we're getting a better fit to the sort of lower limit on days to maturity. So, you know, perhaps, you know, this, you know, because it's very noisy data, it doesn't provide us a clear conclusion, but at least gives us some ideas. And again, just also we can look at this and get a ballpark estimate of temperature ranges for spring wheat. Another one, I haven't taken this so far, but there's a beautiful set of data waiting to be worked with. This was INSOY trials, yield trials done throughout, I guess, essentially tropics and subtropics from 1973 to 1983. I haven't been able to tie the locations to temperature data yet, but just using elevation as a proxy and limiting to a 10-degree north-south band along the equator, so we're not getting big seasonal variation in temperature. For maturity group two, perhaps a suggestion that at cooler temperatures, our seed protein concentration goes up, and for the maturity groups greater than 6, no sign of a temperature trend. And obviously, a lot of more variation within a trial than across the range of temperatures, which presumably are represented by the elevation effect. So a lot of interesting potential there. So that's sort of the multi-environment approach to varying temperature. The other one is to think about either manipulations or planting dates. And so in Arizona, we established this hot cereal experiment with planting dates, essentially about 15 planting dates every 6 weeks for 2 years, with the exception of midsummer when it was just too hot to establish the wheat crops. And so here's an aerial view, a December 1st planting, September 29th planting, October 27th, and January 12th. And within this, you can see we've got some strange apparatus. And this is the infrared heating system, which Bruce Kimball developed. And basically, through infrared heating, we can elevate the temperature. So we were getting 1.3 degrees during the daytime and 2.8 at night. And that was meant to mimic the best estimates of what the climate change scenario would be for our region, and include the controls and references to, in case there was an effective shading of the heaters. We used a single variety, Yacora Rojo, drip irrigation to try and eliminate any effect of water deficits. Well fertilized, and in this environment, we get minimal pest and disease pressure. So we really are looking primarily at a temperature effect. I'll describe mostly work with leaf number, but I think for starches, to show the range of temperatures we can get. Here's our daytime maximum from a little less, the mean curve, a little less than 20, up to about 40 degrees. And you see here at this point, we were able to get the crop germinated, but there was no growth. And so these are the different, from planting to maturity. And here we had two crop failures and another one here. Okay, again, the heaters, this shows how uniform the heating is within the plots. And so Bruce has recently done a nice retrospective analysis, and just looking at grain yield versus average air temperature from emergence to maturity, you know, it looks like obviously yields are going down, and somewhere around, in this case, estimate around 30 or 32 degrees, you're going to hit zero yield with wheat. So looking at leaf numbers, so we monitored main stem leaf appearance for each planting date and heater treatment, and get a range of responses depending on the planting date. So what I want to show you is how we can tease out much more detailed information on temperature response using a simulation modeling approach and what we call inverse modeling. So normally, normals are forward modeling. You take your inputs, you run the model, and you estimate your value, or you simulate your values or your plant responses. In the inverse modeling, we take our field observations and run an optimization process to estimate the parameters. And so in this case, it could be a temperature response parameter, even a cardinal temperature. So here, just to again to explain what we're doing, we take our model, we predict, or we start, say, with some initial estimates of cardinal temperatures or durations for a crop, or in this case for leaf, the filicron interval. We run our model, we simulate the leaf number, we go down through the optimization process, look at our measured data on leaf number, and then revise our estimates and do this until we've found what we consider to be our best estimate of these different temperature parameters. So what I did with these data is there's always this argument about what's the correct shape of the temperature response. So I compared a single segment model, a two segment, a three segment model, a quadratic function, a beta function. And one thing I was want to point out, you know, it's really a challenge with noisy field data, and I would argue with any data, to differentiate among these different curves. So I think, I guess my sort of bias is that it's kind of with the accuracy of data we can hope to get in experimental studies, it's very hard to tell which is the quote best curve. But what we can do is look at the cardinal temperatures and get an estimate. And so here's just for the two-segment model and with leaf number, the root mean squared error. And so about 20, using a 22-degree cardinal temperature for the corner of the optimum and a base temperature of 2 degrees looks like it's about the best fit. So this is, you know, just the inverse modeling approach. And so we can go back then and test differences among the models. So this is analysis of variance. The one-segment model explains most of the variation. The two-segment model improves slightly. And when we get up to the three-segment model, there's no benefit. So there's no evidence that the three-segment model gives us better predictive capability than in one or two. And in the paper this was taken from, we assessed the other models and again found no improvement over a two-segment model. So one issue in this that came up and that we're hoping to review is that what we really need is more data in this high temperature range. And so we're going to try and look for a sweet spot where we can get better data at the highest temperatures without killing the crop off. And this would be both when the temperature is rising in the spring, and then hopefully also as the temperature drops in the fall. So we're proposing an additional series of planting date experiments to revise our estimates of the optimal temperatures. Another issue I want to raise, though, is it's sort of tempting to go out and say, well, we should change our model because we've got better estimates of the temperature responses. But one of the big questions we have is, what temperature is the right temperature? Everything I've presented is based on air temperature. This is the canopy versus air temperature differential. And so what you'll see is that the canopy temperature is running, you know, perhaps on average 5 degrees cooler than the air temperature, with some real excursions from time to time. And there's a lot of variation. The blue line is wind speed, and when we get high wind speed, you know, obviously there's more mixing, and so we get a reduced canopy temperature differential. So we think probably if we're going to pursue temperature responses, we need a better model with an energy balance that actually calculates the crop temperature. Now I want to just show another example, and if this wasn't planned, I didn't have Greg, you know, talk before, but I think there's this wonderful thing which is the McMaster paradox, and we all know that it's the crown temperature which regulates wheat development. You know, that's what we're always told. And Greg thought, well, I'm going to go out and do a field experiment and show that this is true. And so he tried a control versus soil warming of plus 3 degrees, And what he actually found was minimal effect on leaf appearance. So here's three different planting dates with this very nice soil warming effect, except that it's not there. It's not reflected in the leaf numbers. And something Greg has suggested, which I think would be fascinating to pursue, is it may be that the plant is actually sampling temperature all over the place and that we're getting an integrated signal. You say everywhere there's meristematic tissue, it may be responding to temperature. So sort of the question is, what is the plant temperature? Is it the canopy temperature? Is it the crown temperature? Or is it some integrated measure of various temperatures? So congratulations to McMaster for propagating paradoxes. So in conclusion, I just want to say field-based evaluations work. Planned experiments are preferable, but retrospective studies of multi-environment trials are still useful. I think inverse modeling shows a lot of promise and actually has been used for years to filtering out the confounding effects of photoperiod. There's some issues there about model quality and how to deal with very large amounts of data. And I think there's still some concerns we need to investigate about site bias and particularly effects of the vapor pressure or humidity regime. And so I want to put out to the community, what we really need are coordinated multi-location planting date trials. You have standardized your genotypes, your measurement protocols, and particularly the weather data you're obtaining, the management within the constraints of different locations, and seek sites that differ in humidity and diurnal range. And I would say, for example, for wheat, you know, a beautiful study would be, say, do Salinas Valley, several locations in Arizona where you have a range of elevation, but also this huge temperature variation, the Gulf Coast, and maybe Puerto Rico. And I think if we had a good coordinated study with, say, 20 or 30 temperature regimes, we could really nail down a lot more about temperature responses. So thank you.
Couple of questions.
Yes.
Chef, I'm just curious, what's the difference between multiple regression and inverse modeling?
Well, I think in inverse modeling, you have the potential, say with photoperiod would be a good example. With multiple regression, you just put in a factor for photoperiod. And with inverse modeling, you say, what's our best understanding of how photoperiod affects, if it was in the case of phenology. So really it's a different, well, I'd say using inverse modeling with simulation, you're trying to incorporate as much as you understand of the underlying physiology. So I think multiple regression is a good exploratory tool, but if we have a simulation model and we're confident of the physiology, that's probably a better approach. Jeff? Okay, so your Cora Rojo. Okay, oh, I'm sorry. So Jeff is asking, are we sure that our spring wheats are not photoperiod sensitive? And in this case, your Cora Rojo is one of the Green Revolution wheats that the Simic group bred through shuttle breeding, and so they do have a very low photoperiod response. But if the simulation model correctly represents the effects of photoperiod, in an inverse modeling approach, you should be able to factor out the photoperiod effect. Now, there's an important assumption there, which is that the model correctly represents the photoperiod response. But there's basically the answer.
All right. With that, we're going to have to move on. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you.